Hey, this is Frank, author of the Host Deep Dive book, and you're listening to my buddy Speed and John on the Virtual Speaking Podcast.
What is virtualization?
You're going to learn today.
Innovate like a startup, deliver like an enterprise.
I hope you're coffeeed up and ready because it's going to be a great day.
I know you're going to dig this.
Oh, yeah.
You're listening to the Virtually Speaking Podcast with Pedro Aero and John Nicholson.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Virtually Speaking Podcast, episode number 161. My name is Pete Fletcher, a.k.a. Pedro Aero, and joining me once again is Mr. John Nicholson. John, how you doing, buddy?
Feeling forgetful, Pete. Can't find my keys, can't find anything. Like, I can remember all these useless facts, but I can't remember anything important.
Interesting. You're having problems with your memory is what you're saying. So you're just going to slide straight into the cheesy segue.
No, we're going straight into the cheesy segue.
I love it. Well, that's okay with me, man, because we're going to need as much time as possible on this one, because this is quite a lengthy topic, and man, did we bring on the right guest for this one. Today, we're talking about dynamic memory management, and man, I cannot think of a better person to talk about anything that has to do with resources than our good friend, Mr. Frank Denneman. Frank, welcome back to the podcast.
Hi, guys. Thanks again for having me.
Hey, first off the bat, man, love the beard. What's going on here? Is this your COVID look?
It's my Corona beard. So I knew I wasn't traveling for a couple of months. So I'm like, well, let's try this one.
I like it.
Let's try it out.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's growing on me. I like it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice. Sweet. Well, listen, hey, before we even start, Frank, as always, thanks for coming on. Thanks for all the content that you share. In preparation, if you're listening to this podcast and you know it's about dynamic memory management and you want to learn a little bit, man, we're going to talk for 30 or so minutes, but you really need to get your hands on a couple of books. Obviously, one of them is the Host Resources Deep Dive. There's several other books that Frank's written, the Clustering Deep Dive. But man, the Host Resources Deep Dive, just on memory alone, has 200 pages dedicated to it. So, I mean, this is probably the most authoritative book I can think of when it comes to memory. Not even just for VMware, but just literally understanding server memory, period. And then, of course, it goes into the VM kernel and all of the different, you know, memory reclamation strategies. And we're going to cover some of those today. But man, Frank, every time I look for anything memory related, I read this book and I'm just so humbled that we're friends, because this is a really, really great resource. So thanks for that.
So thank you for the extremely nice compliment. And to be honest, yeah, it's 200 pages, and I often need to read it myself as well. Because, you tend to forget stuff, right? And that was the reason why I actually wrote the book, because, hey, you want to have it in all in one place.
Yeah, for sure. Let's get into it. So one of the more common questions we get around VMware pertaining to memory are all the different things to set for DRS, for dynamic memory management. And so I thought it would be a good idea to just cover, maybe walk through some of the memory reclamation techniques and why they're there. Maybe we can dive into various ones. But before we do that, why don't you just kick us off by giving us a high-level explanation of what is dynamic memory management?
Yeah, so I think the key part of all memory management in vSphere is the fact that not every workload is active 100% of the time. That means that you can share the physical resource. That's the premise in this case, of virtualization. That's how we started. You have multiple active workloads. Instead of giving each workload a physical box, let's try to consolidate and try to manage it in a way so that the activity is distributed. And because of that, you need to have this kernel, this scheduler that allows multiple virtual machines to actually use the physical resources. And that's what the kernel does. Yep. Well, really well.
Yeah.
Well, I've always felt like CPU overcommitment was a bit easier to understand, because you see utilization, it's very bursty, very real time. But memory with virtual machines and applications, people seem to think of, instead of it as a real-time commodity like CPU or power, something that comes and goes and is very bursty, they see, oh, this application has grabbed 2 gigabytes in resource manager, task manager, and I assume it's just holding on to that forever. But it sounds like there's a lot more depth here.
There is. It's an onion. Peel away the layers. And so an interesting part is What makes it difficult is the information gap. If you look at Windows, when a application in Windows uses memory, the memory management in Windows knows it. But the moment the application doesn't use it anymore, that memory manager will actually place that memory page in another list, in a free list or whatever. But it doesn't inform the kernel. So the kernel doesn't know whether or not this memory is used, whether or not it's actually important. We all know the Java stories and with the reservation and all that stuff.
Oh yeah.
But the reality is, one of the interesting things is we understand the activity of a particular page in a virtual machine. So we do have an idea of which memory is used more often. And because of that, we can actually make intelligent decisions. So although we don't have this intimate communication between the guest OS and the kernel OS, we do have good insights on the use of things.
So tracking memory, that sounds like a really hard problem, because in order to track something that's loading and unloading that fast, you're going to generate a lot of telemetry. And by nature, you generally stuff telemetry in something faster than what it already is. And memory is generally, I guess you can go to CPU cache. Is that hardware offloaded, or how is that tracking?
Yeah, we do have some hardware offloading elements, but the way it typically works is actually using averages, not looking at every single page in a system. Think about how a ESX server or hypervisor looked 15 years ago. How many memory did we put in an ESX box? 32 gigs. And look at what we're doing right now.
Well, you were rich if you had 32 gigs of RAM here, Mr. Moneybags.
Well, I didn't. My customers did. But the reality is, what is the average memory capacity of a current host? We're talking to customers with 6 terabytes of memory. And you cannot track every single page. So you need to do some smart. You need to do some statistical averages.
So obviously, memory's gotten a lot lighter. It looks like we've got some really fun ways to track it. But you know, one thing is from an allocation basis, we're not scared today to overallocate CPU generally. I mean, outside of some niche workloads, you know, people have different rules of thumb. You know, 4 cores, you know, or whatever that 5 cores, whatever they don't want to go beyond. There's ways to monitor that, but is memory allocation, that's been an interesting one, because we go back, as you say, to when memory was very expensive, where, you know, Mr. Moneybags here had 32 gigs of RAM, and now we go to, you know, 364. We used to overallocate memory quite a bit, and it seems like something we've kind of shied away from. What are some of those technologies? What are some of those motives? I mean, is it still a dirty word, or is it something we should consider?
I would recommend to consider it still. Right, especially when you understand that not every workload is active all the time. So there is some room to play, and that allows you to provide the guest OS and the application a little bit more room to breathe, while at the machine part, the physical part, you can squeeze some of the things. Now, we have some interesting allocation technologies, and I think one, and I'm going to bring this back to life from the past, is transparent page sharing. TPS. That's a really interesting discussion to have for a lot of our customers, because TPS is not disabled and something we always think, especially with all the security going on. But what we do right now is we look at memory pages that can be shared within a virtual machine.
So this is like a pseudo deduplication of memory.
Yeah. And you still see benefits from that, right? Another thing is what we do is we are looking at zero pages inside a virtual machine. There's a lot of zeroing going on, and we collapse them into one physical page per NUMA node. So that's also a very good way to reduce the number of physical memory allocations.
Oh, but that's interesting. So storage industry has done this for a while, to where even with dedupe, you treated a page full of zeros as special and you just always have a reserve block. But that's interesting that you have 1 0 page per NUMA node. So if you're calling the page that's zero, you know, because there's probably a lot of errant zero pages, you don't want that to be a remote call and add that latency and go bug the other, you know, NUMA node.
Yeah, my zero is your zero, right? So that's an easy way to collapse. And if you think about this from a security perspective, if you're afraid, we have copy on write. The moment we want to write something, we automatically copy the content to a new page, and then you can write whatever you want. And that's part of the virtual machine itself that isn't shared, so on and so on.
Well, and there's not going to be an SSL key and a page full of zeros. It's just, if that's your key, then you're the idiot with the easiest to guess luggage combo here.
So. Yeah. That's a good way to put it.
Getting back to the security, what we're specifically speaking about, right, is the shared memory attacks that have popped up across the x86 processors, right? And this is the whole construct of one virtual machine potentially being able to, through various attack methods, either alter other memory pages on other systems or read them. And this is things ranging from like Rowhammer to various other attacks. What have we done? What have we changed about TPS, and what can customers do? You know, what are the knobs that they can turn there?
The first thing what we did was we're not going to share pages anymore between virtual machines. So that means that the virtual machine has extremely difficulties to get to other pages that doesn't belong to it. That's one. And I think it's a really successful way of managing this threat. Now, a lot of our customers, especially VDI customers, they do a risk assessment and they say, I don't think we're exposed. So can we benefit from TPS? And one thing that we can do is we provide advanced settings. It's called salting. And that allows VMs to share memory when the salt number is identical. From that point on, every virtual machine that has an identical salt number will share pages with each other. Or let me rephrase that. We collapse similar pages to one single physical page. The moment a virtual machine copies that and wants to write it, we copy that page and we write it to the new page. So it's still secure, but in essence, you have access to the same memory pages that other virtual machines share.
So if I've got a VDI, maybe per pool, I might do a salt. So if I've got a VDI for a high security group, they would get a different salt.
Exactly.
Or another, I guess, use case I might think here is like a web server farm where they're all the same security class. Like anything that's in one's memory is just, you know, assume the same security ring, I guess, between them. But let's say like my connection or my, if it's an older view environment, my security servers or my gateways, my load balancers that are holding the SSL cert. Okay, completely different salt. We don't want users ripping, you know. And again, we're talking about theoretical attacks that in theory have been patched, but we're worried about future classes of, so.
Yeah. So that gives you this manageability of pooling. And I think you said it right. It's, you look at particular classes, you look at identical usage, and you can solve it. If you're saying, look, I've got a really good perimeter, I don't believe anybody can break in that perimeter, and I don't have malicious users, you can open it up. Your call, of course.
It's test dev. There's no actual user data. There's no PII in there. Who cares?
Yeah, for example. So VMware will never recommend you to do this due to the fact that you need to understand the ramification on a security level in order to do this.
Yeah.
But if you went through that exercise, there are opportunities and there are advanced settings that allows you to go back to almost the old days of TPS, and that is share everything. Now, there are some limitations, of course, and that's primarily due to performance reasons. One of the things is NUMA boundaries. So typically you have multiple CPUs in your system, and each CPU, each package has its own memory controller, thus that is deemed local memory. Now, what we do is we try to keep the memory access as local as possible, because that's the best, that's the highest bandwidth, that's the lowest latency. One thing you don't want to do is you want to share a memory page that's on remote memory, meaning memory still in the same system, attached to a different physical CPU, a different physical memory controller, because that will, you will need, when you access stuff, you will need to go through the interconnect, through the system. That takes time and reduces your bandwidth.
What is that latency increase, like from 10 nanoseconds to 20 or 30? It's something, it's a decent jump, right?
It is a decent jump. And
I'd have to go read the book to remember numbers. What the numbers are. But
I got a great recommendation for
you.
But I mean, thinking about that though, even if we say, well, in the real, real old days, we might have done this global, and we're, because memory, you know, costs an arm and a leg and not $3 or $4 a gigabyte, but even with those NUMA boundaries becoming boundaries for TPS, people are still stuffing so much more memory in than before. You're still at a net gain. Yep. The other one is, you mentioned, if we go back to the real old Stone Age, is the size of those memory pages that we would analyze. It used to be smaller, and then there was, I think, a memory pressure threshold, or if you went above 93, it changed, right? Or
yeah, we have what's called nowadays, in the newer versions, we call it's min-free. That means we're going to calculate based on the amount of memory in a system. We are going to calculate a number of, or a pool of memory, that once the utilization of the system is beyond a certain threshold, we're going to look to reclaim some memory. And we'll do this in a lenient way up to a very aggressive way. The most aggressive way is block, but we're talking 100% utilization, and we're talking about all like a real bad Christmas tree. Everything lights up. And
yeah, when the alternative is swap, and swap is going to be brutal on CPU because you'll have CPU cycles.
Yeah. Out.
But I assume this costs CPU. Yeah. So it sounds like the scheduler is sitting here and basically saying, do I want to burn CPU and do smaller and smaller blocks rather than pages or break up page sizes? Mm-hmm. Or do I want to be gentle on my CPU usage because I have free RAM? It's just like an auto sliding scale, but you don't have to think about it. It just does it, right?
It does it, yes. And it's so smart. And one of the things that I really like about it is that we have actually two thresholds. We have a threshold that keeps track of the ramping up of memory consumption and the actual effect of reclaiming memory and the reduction of memory allocation. Because what things, if you have a threshold that is used for both, meaning that if you go beyond a certain threshold, you're going to reclaim memory, there's going to be a point where you're going to end up below the threshold again, meaning at that point, you don't have to reclaim anymore. But if you have a really efficient algorithm, you're just going to past that particular threshold, and then that's when you're going to stop, right?
You do want to avoid diminishing returns and get value.
Yeah, so there is this system where you don't want to go slightly beyond a particular point, because typically if there's a spike, you're going back into the reclaim mode, which isn't helpful because every reclamation...
You don't want it to just be sitting there bouncing in and out.
Exactly. So what we've done is we've set the threshold differently. So the moment we go beyond a certain point, but the moment we reclaim memory, we're going to reclaim a little bit extra.
To give you a buffer to prevent it from cycling back on. It's like my air conditioner. It'll cool an extra degree below so it doesn't have to keep cycling on and off.
Exactly. So it does that automatically as well. And that makes it so beautiful, because what we've done with the ESXi schedulers is that we've optimized it so much that we're trying to reduce the number of CPU and memory consumption for these things, because we really want the customer to use those resources to actually run the workload that they want to run on, instead of giving it away to a scheduler process. So in order to be as efficient as possible, sometimes you need to reclaim a little bit more in order for you to stop wasting CPU cycles to manage things.
Yeah, so the min-free definitely had a lot of advances over the years. I know previous versions of it, you know, the calculation of min-free was a certain amount, but as memory sizes got bigger, that could result in wasting a lot of memory based on just doing a hardcore percentage. But over the newer versions of ESXi, we've seen a lot of changes in that area. Is that correct?
That is correct. For every system, we apply the same calculations up to 28 gigs. So from 0 to 28 gigs, we have three percentage numbers. And then it depends on the amount of memory that you actually put in the host. And overall, it's roughly 1%. 1% from 28 gigs to the end. And that's the number of memory we use as a threshold. You still can allocate it. You still can use it. But from that point on, we're going to say, look, we need to reclaim memory in order to make the system still work and to make everything as optimal as possible. And first of all, we are going to break the large pages, and then we're going to balloon. And at one point, we're going to compress, and then we're going to swap, and then we're going to block.
Yeah.
But the moment you go from compress to swap to block, that's a different discussion.
Yeah, you're going from, you know, 10 nanoseconds or something to microseconds, or God forbid, if it's on like a remote enough array, or if it's on magnetic disk, like milliseconds. It's, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, for sure.
It's the difference between, like, you know, me walking across the street to get my mail to getting on a spaceship and flying to Mars in terms of distance. Like, that latency gap is just brutal.
It can be insane. And the problem with swap is that we don't understand, because we have that information gap. We're going to grab some pages as fast as we can, and not always is that a page from a free list, right? And there are some good dynamic elements in the system to use to protect you from that situation. And one of the things is a memory reservation. We have two of those. We have per virtual machine reservation, and we have a per resource pool reservation.
Per memory reservation sounds painful and like way too much work.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, we like to call it the diva reservation because
I've worked with that DBA. Allocating. I've worked with that DBA. sir, here is your tiara and your cape, and yes, of course we're going to give you 1 terabyte of memory. While I silently on the back end put like I'm not even kind. I don't even set like a low reservation. I put a limit. I'm like, I'm gonna make him swap. Let him eat swap.
Limits is, by the way, an interesting thing because a lot of people don't know that if you apply a limit to a virtual machine and the system is not in an overcommitted state, so we're not hitting that min-free threshold, we're still going to swap because we're basically saying with a limit, this is the amount of physical memory that you can allocate, and everything else needs to come for something else, which is typically a swap.
So what is the purpose of a limit other than me being punitive to DBAs that are annoying me? Or I'm a service provider and I just want to be able to extort people for more money. Like what is the practical?
So the history, it's an interesting story. The history behind the limit was actually a way for the engineers to create a over allocation state.
Oh, to test what swap looked like.
Yeah. Without actually pushing the system to the actual limit. And I don't know who, but somebody thought it was actually a good idea to expose it to our customers. So it was an engineering option.
We can make this a feature.
Yeah.
I mean, I've enjoyed using it to take vengeance upon those who have requested stupid amounts of resources.
Well, and it's not only about stupidity. Actually, there are some good stories to tell about limit, because think about vCloud Director. Think about our provider customers.
Yeah, if the customer's not paying for it, yeah, you know.
Well, there are some customers that want to do multi-tenancy on vSphere, and they want to carve up a particular amount of resources to their customers.
Oh, and maybe they're doing like a QE test on an application load that the application has to see 20 gigs of memory. Like, or I think it was Horizon, the connection service. If you install with too low memory, it sets a completely different heap size or something. And so there's actually times where you don't actually need to use the memory, you don't want to use the memory, you don't want to pay for it to use the memory, maybe at a CMP platform level, but you need to expose it for particularly like QE of apps. I guess that would be...
That's one good use case. Another use case is, let's say I'm a customer of Rackspace or another provider.
Okay.
And I want to run 20 virtual machines with 1 terabyte. They're not going to create a cluster for me with 1 terabyte. They're just basically carving up a cluster and I'm giving me a resource pool with 1 terabyte, with a limit of 1 terabyte.
Oh, the limit on the resource pool. Now that makes a lot.
Yeah.
Now that makes sense.
Yeah. Not on a per virtual machine level. No. Okay. If you think reservations on a virtual machine is bad, well, like I said, right?
Limits are even worse.
You set a limit to a virtual machine. Yeah, it's worse. Now, but the interesting part of that resource pool is it's fully dynamic. And that's something that people use it for folders.
Right,
let's
right.
not go into that one.
Yeah, that's
triggered.
But
resource pools are not folders.
No, not at
that
all.
That could be the title of the episode.
Okay. Yeah.
But you can nest them. I mean.
Yeah, you can create a hierarchy, and that's really cool.
So like have production and test, and then create subgroups within it, you know. That way I can organize my databases into a separate folder. I mean, resource group within the production one. So.
Yeah, so what a resource pool is, it's an interesting thing. So if you look at a cluster is a producer of resources. You attach some host to it, and that those hosts provide resources to the cluster. The cluster is meant, and that's how it's designed, to act as a single computer, a single pool of resources. So if you have four hosts, they each have 100 gigs of memory, and that means the cluster is a computer of 400 gigs. Now, the moment you create resource pools, that resource pool below the cluster level, and the cluster level is the root resource pool, the resource pool below it is a child resource pool. And that child resource pool is, interestingly enough, a consumer, because it consumes resources from the root resource pool, but it's also a producer. Mm. It produces the amount of resources for the virtual machines, or in this, in the newer, in vSphere 7, vSphere pods, to provide resources to its child objects, the virtual machines and the pods. That is the interesting part. So what it does, if you say, I want to have 100 gigs, I want to have 100 gigs of memory, and you put 100 gigs of reservation and 100 gigs of limit. So it's a fully guaranteed environment. That resource pool immediately is going to consume that 100 gigs from the root resource pool, from the cluster. And it provides the resources to the virtual machines. And that's based on an activity. The moment a virtual machine lights up and wants to have that memory, it actually gets it based on its relative priority amongst its siblings, the childs within the resource pool.
So that's where the share, the high, medium, low.
Yes.
Which is a lot easier than trying to tune individual VMs. So.
Yeah, we can go into scalable shares as well, but we need to have at least another half hour.
Yeah, no, I'm thinking, let's avoid this becoming a 12-episode podcast. We'll bring you back on.
Read the article I recently posted on my blog.
So I'll share that on the show notes of the link for sure. But bringing it up one level real quick is, you know, you talked about, you know, the mistakes of using resource pools as folders and assigning, you know, individual memory to specific users. What do you think are some of the more common mistakes people make when it comes to memory allocation?
Yeah, I don't want to call them mistakes, but one thing that is interesting for a lot of our customers that are not on 7.0, there is this advanced option in DRS. Memory metric actually it's an additional option. And what it does, it triggers DRS to look at consumed memory instead of active memory. Now, going back to the old days, so here's the thing. DRS was introduced in 2006. Yep. To give you an idea, that was 1 year before Apple introduced the iPhone. So think about life back then, right? Can you remember?
No, I don't actually.
If we go back, exactly. The world looked differently from a virtualization perspective. We were all busy trying to consolidate active usage onto a single box. But during the years, virtualization has become more than only consolidation. It's all about mobility. It's all about automation. It's a way to change your operations at an IT level. Now, with that, a lot of our customers, like what we said in the beginning, a lot of our customers shy away from memory over commitment. So trying to schedule and balance on active workloads doesn't make sense. You're going to see really weird behavior. And it doesn't make sense for most users because they think, hey, I intended this cluster to behave like X. Why doesn't DRS understand this? Well, DRS is, I think, deployed at 400,000 customers or something like that. We have no insight on your intention of actually how you use the product. So we have to come up with an average use of DRS, and it doesn't change or it's difficult to align. And what we've seen throughout the years is that, hey, most of our customers went to not a fully overcommit situation, but they're trying to go halfway, a little bit overcommit, but not like every virtual machine has its own physical memory. And for that use case, we have introduced the additional option about memory metric balancing. And that allows DRS to consider consumed, and consumed is what the virtual machine has allocated from a physical perspective. And that aligns way better to more the modern use, what customers use vSphere for. So that's, I think, the option that is missed the most. Now, from another part, limits, no go. I wouldn't touch limit in the first place from a virtual machine level perspective, like what John was talking about. Resource pools, don't use this. Folders, of course. But here's the thing. try to think about resource pools as a dynamic way of creating a quality of service pool. Use a resource pool, assign physical memory to it with a reservation, and then start to load that resource pool with the virtual machine. So you have that dynamic element of activity while you're still guaranteeing the number of physical resources. Now, with that said, the moment you commit to a resource pool structure is keep on committing. If you're going to place a virtual machine next to a resource pool so that that virtual machine is a sibling to a resource pool, you might see some weird behavior because now the resource pool needs to divide the memory on a share level, if you're not using reservations for everything, based on the size of the virtual machine and the size of the resource pool.
Yeah.
To give you an idea, a resource pool is actually sized as a 4 GPU, 16 gig virtual machine. That's the share value of a normal resource pool. So if you have a monster VM sitting next to it, you're going to see a different behavior, right? So every memory allocation beyond the reservation, so between the reservation and the limit, is allocated based on share. And you have this relative priority, so you need to battle it out with that monster VM sitting next to you. That will be your noisy neighbor, for sure.
Yeah, for sure. That makes sense.
Wow. Yeah, no, I've always just created a resource pool called No Reservation, and that was like the dumping ground for everything that wasn't going into some type of... Maybe here's my feature request. We should have one called Trash Can for just all the other, like, or miscellaneous, like, you know, that drawer you have, like the junk drawer? We'll call it the junk drawer. We can have a junk drawer as like a default resource group. So we've talked a lot about resource groups. We've talked extensively about TPS. Let's just go real quick through the other. Okay, so we've maxed out TPS. We're doing TPS. Ballooning, compression, swap to SSD, then swap. So we've got our other, I guess, get out of jail free cards. What do these look like? What are the impacts? You know, what do we need to do? So let's start with what ballooning.
Ballooning is a really elegant function, and I think it's an undervalued function. Let me start with explaining ballooning. Ballooning is the process where the hypervisor asks the guest OS, "Can you give me some? Can you lend me $5?" That's basically what the hypervisor does too.
And this requires what be installed? VM tools.
Yeah, the
right?
VM tools. We have that balloon driver in the VM tools, and that allows us to communicate with the guest OS. So the moment we ask the guest OS, "Can you give me some memory?" That memory needs to be found by the guest OS. So that takes some time. The moment we get it from the guest OS, what we're doing is we're allocating those pages to nothing.
A null value. So if you try to call it, you're not going to steal memory from another VM or anything. It's just you get nothing back.
Yeah, the guest OS thinks that particular process wants memory. Look, I always thought about how we depict ballooning and how we explain ballooning didn't make sense to me at all. Because I saw this balloon, and I'm like, what do you mean? What is a balloon?
Well, it's like there's some other idle workloads and this driver just starts grabbing memory and slowly kind of, the analogy to me though, felt like it was like pushing, it was bumping into and pushing the other workloads.
Exactly. That process asked the guest OS, "Give me some memory." And so the guest OS thinks, "Oh, this is another valid process. I need to give it some memory. Let me figure out a way to give it memory." It gets the memory. So we know what we're doing nothing with it. So that means for us, it's a way to reduce the number of physical pages, because we are 100% sure that memory is not used by any process inside the guest OS. That is actually a valid workload. Now, what we're trying to do with what we're hoping for the guest OS to do is to actually give us memory that's part of the free list, that's part of the things that are not used by the application. Because like I said in the beginning, the information gap, we have no idea what is useful memory for that particular application at that particular time. But the guest OS knows this because the guest OS talks to the application. So it will give memory that is less important to that application itself. That is a very, very elegant way of dealing with dynamic usage. And if we do this on multiple virtual machines, and it doesn't have to be large amounts per virtual machine, but all the bits help, and it allows us to reduce the pressure. Now, the problem with that, it's a process that takes a little bit of time. Typically, what you see is that the reason why memory pressure occurs is that there's some weird things going on. Maybe there's load synchronicity, meaning that at one point, every virtual machine is going to blast. A great example, of course, is a virus scanner, right? And you know this from a storage perspective as well. Look at all the IOs hitting the controllers. Yeah. But also, think about Monday morning, 9 o'clock. Everybody's, or in the old days, everybody's is appearing at the office. And they're going to log on. So we're hitting the Active Directory global catalog. We're hitting the Exchange server. We're doing all these things. So at that point, if you look at the virtualization layer, everything lights up. Where does this resources, where they come from? Well, from the physical part. So that's the load synchronicity. Mm-hmm. Load correlation is front end request traveling from the front end to the back end. So you see this part of load flowing through the system from one virtual machine to another virtual machine. That can have some effect as well, especially if they're all on the same host. So these things happen at a rapid pace, and the balloon driver is not always able to keep up with that pace. It responds to a certain moment, and then it has to start to discuss with the guest OS, give me some.
And DRS may have to move, say, okay, I've got room for you here, but not here, so we got to go move some VMs around or shuffle.
Exactly. Yeah, and so one of the things that we've improved in 7.0, in vSphere 7.0, is we went from 5 minutes invocation to a 60-second invocation.
Oh, wow. So if we start getting an SLA breach, we can move quick now.
Yeah, well, actually, it's even better because what DRS does, the moment it sees a placement, that means power on, or a vMotion, it triggers an invocation. It triggers a load balancing algorithm.
Oh, it says go scan and see if you can.
Yep.
Do we need a balloon? Do we need to move?
Oh,
do we need
smart.
To? Okay.
Do we need to? Is there another host that is more efficient for a particular virtual machine?
Yeah.
That is what DRS does. Right. In
Well, it's always kind of a Lego stacking effect because you might be powering on a VM that needs 64 gigs, but you have a bunch of ones with one that are easier to fit into smaller gaps. And
yeah.
Okay, so we've got through. You know, we've got through the easier ones that are largely, you know, we've got TPS, we got ballooning, make sure your tools are up to date. Let's get to the heavier ones. These are the ones that if we see, you know, you start to worry about performance a bit more, swapping and the two.
And you're forgetting one.
Oh, compression.
That's cool
compression.
Part. Yes.
Well.
And that's a beauty as well.
What is the impact of compression? That's something I've never fully understood.
Okay. You have to re-ask the question. What impact does it have when I don't have compression?
Oh, okay, yeah, that's true. It is better than swapping.
Exactly, right? So you're already past a particular point. So look, if you design things correct, and if everything works, and if you're using the full stack, it is likely that you won't go into that point, right? Now, let's say that you're into this scenario, because one of the things that can happen—
Half of my hosts have caught fire, you know, and I—
Exactly. Right?
I was patching. I had two hosts down and another one failed and something awful's happened.
Perfect storm. Now, that's where compression comes into play because compression is, we ballooning isn't able to catch up quickly enough. Let's, instead of go directly to swap, let's compress some stuff. Yes, you're going to see some overhead because we need to have some CPU cycles for it. And access of memory is slower, but at the moment it's compressed and we need to access that particular memory page, we need to decompress it. That's some overhead, but it's still better than swapping, especially when you think about having a swap on a magnetic disk in a galaxy far, far away.
Wow.
Because, right, we don't, if you don't have vSAN, if you don't have it close to the CPU on a PCI device, you're going over the network to a storage controller, right, you're going to have some bad times. So compression is the way to go forward. Now, that is limited to an X amount. We cannot compress every memory. We have a limited space to compress. And that's when swapping comes into play. Now, swapping is, well, that's another question, like, is swapping bad? Well, if you look at it from, is it bad from a performance perspective? Yes. Am I keeping my servers still alive? Am I most of my virtual machines services still alive? Yes. Then it's not as bad as you think it is.
Yeah, the alternative is a hard crash.
Yes.
But you've got some challenges here. One, you're going to need capacity for the swap, which if you didn't, you know, which I think vSphere by default, if you've set reservations, that's thin, obviously, but you've got storage that's required. So you don't, because if you run out of memory and then you run out of storage, you're going to have a really bad day. The other thing is what about swap placement? And this used to be something we'd do kind of weird where we would like have a swap LUN so that way we wouldn't replicate the swap. And then there was like swap to a local storage device was popular. I've seen some of these really fast local memory persistent Eoptane devices. Like, is swap to SSD something we still use, or is it kind of a vestigial feature?
That's a good question. And to be honest, I haven't checked.
I haven't used that setting in forever.
No. But if we look at the basics, if we look at the theory, the swap closer by is faster than a swap far away. So I would rather have it locally than remotely. Now, the problem with local swap is typically the capacity is more expensive than a magnetic disk on an array.
Oh, yeah.
So.
Well, and with swap
it's local, a trade-off.
I mean, I feel like part of this also comes down to is if you're having to design for swap local, like, wait, and you've already blown through all these safeties to get to this point, it's like, okay, wait, are we really that tight on budget? Like, and you actually have to deploy a local device. And I could see this feature coming back into use with these. There are some persistent classes, like these things that are fast, slower than memory slightly, but still faster than flash, that are starting to kind of come out. And so that might become a thing. But I think from a design perspective, yeah, we have to ask ourselves, if we've blown through this many safeties, or at this point, like, this, we're getting some really avant-garde design here.
Yes. And so I totally agree with you. Now, using PMEM for swap locations, I'd rather buy some extra memory, because I think that's more less expensive than putting in PMEM, especially if you use.
Oh yeah, PMEM persistent memory. You're right. Some of the like, it's more the Optane like block on DEM.
So
you're talking like $1.50 versus $3 per gig. But at that point, it's like, okay, really? Come on, just buy some more DRAM.
Yeah. The good news is there's a lot of extensive conversation around all the different swap and locating swap, relocating swap, all that stuff in the book. So yeah. Another plug here. I know we're not sponsored, but it is really a great read. It's the Host Resources deep dive on there.
Well, to be honest, you can buy it at Amazon, but if you look closely online, there is still a URL, hostdeepdive.com, that offers the book for free, the ebook.
Oh, there you go.
And let's face it, I'm not naive. There are so many copies floating around on different platforms.
Honestly, I treat certain authors, you know, like I treat certain musicians, you know, like, for example, the Foo Fighters. I have Spotify. I listen to the Foo Fighters for free, but I will pay for every Foo Fighter album because I support the artist. And I do the same with certain resources. I prefer to support the professional as opposed to saving $9 and, you know. So, Frank, one last question before we let you go. Like, I know there's a increase in the use of containers. And I was curious, you know, containers are slightly different. They're very efficient, but they're also very dense. How does containers change from an administrator's perspective in terms of memory allocation? Are there any considerations?
Pretty much they're same. But the good part is the way the developer deploys containers, where he or she can state particular classes. A guaranteed class, for example, that's a quality of service class, meaning that I want to have all my memory guaranteed. You can have a best effort where you say, "Oh, let's roll the dice." And these things allow the developer to express their requirements for the application in a way better. Now, one thing that is interesting is the size of containers. And that's going to be interesting in the next few years, because I actually had a call with a customer today, and they're using ESXi host to run one container.
One container.
Let's sync that. Yes, let's sync that one in. I'm not sure what the use case was. I know what the use case was from an application perspective, but I didn't understand why you go to a container when you create a container of a couple of terabytes of memory and a gazillion cores. But the reality is, what I'm trying to say is, we have to treat containers as containers, meaning efficient, small-sized elements that are completely tuned to the application requirements. There is, we try to reduce the overhead by virtualizing the guest OS. Let's keep it that way. With virtual machines, we have to load the guest OS, and we have to do all these things, which is a good thing from an isolation perspective. That's a little bit bigger. But what is interesting is how are the upcoming customers that are new to containers, how are they going to treat containers? How are they going to treat them as virtual machines, as I will give you an X amount of memory and figure it out? Or is it more elegant and efficient and but also more micromanagement? So they're going to be, the interesting part is what toolings will appear that allows us to increase the management of things. One of the things that we're doing with vSphere 7 is namespaces. We allow the IT admin or the IT ops to define a namespace to provide an X amount of memory, a SPBM policy for the right storage quality of service. And we expose an API endpoint for the developer. Here you go, go knock yourself out. So it's similar to what we've been discussing with Resource Pool. And I believe that that is the future. If our customers align with it, that's going to be the thing I'm real curious about.
Nice. Yeah, for sure.
So all this, it just sounds like a hypervisor is a commodity.
I think I'm running out of time here.
Kidding.
Yes. Well, here's the thing. Every vendor has a hypervisor. But the reality is that the full stack that is attached to the hypervisor is the key. Now, some hypervisors have a higher quality. If you look at the ESX hypervisor, and I'm not saying that because I work for VMware, but it's been proven that we have the most efficient schedulers inside the hypervisor. If you look at what we said at VMworld about, we're running a container that is more efficient than the Linux guest OS can do by itself. That says a lot, right? So even with the overhead of running that guest OS, we're still faster, we're still better, we're still more efficient. That really, really says enough how much we've been tinkering and designing our platforms. But the reality is, like you said, with the Lego blocks, think about this. We have a memory scheduler. We have a CPU scheduler. We have a NUMA optimization. That's from a host perspective. Then we go to vCenter. There we have DRS that can see what host is more efficient for this virtual machine. And then we have other elements. Think about VROps. Think about cloud health. VRealize can actually look beyond cluster boundaries. VRealize can provide DRS with information that allows DRS to actually move virtual machines to other hosts before the load starts to appear, because we do trend analysis over a long period of time. You cannot do that with the other hypervisors. There is no integrated stack that provides this ability going from deep level, incredibly optimized hardware level management to all the way up to I can go beyond pools of executions. And I think that is the real power of what we've been delivering for the last 15 years.
Yeah, well said. Well said. All right, Frank, I know it's getting late in the Netherlands, so I'm going to let you go, man. But man, I really appreciate this breakdown of dynamic memory allocation and reclamation techniques. This is a keeper, man. I appreciate it. For those of you that don't know Frank, he's on Twitter at Frank Deniman. His website is frankdeniman.dl. And if you're going to VMworld, which is going to be remote this year, you're going to definitely want to check out his sessions. Awesome. Frank, appreciate it, man.
Thanks again for having me.
All right. Well, that music tells me it's time to go. And so if you want to get in touch with us, send us an email at podcast@vmware.com. You can subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice by searching Virtually Speaking Podcast. You can catch this and all episodes at vspeakingpodcast.com. A big thanks to Frank Deniman for joining us. We're back next week, but until then, bye for now.
Enough of this jibber jabber.